Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dorothy Gundy, Mario Ritter Jr., and Jill Robbins. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dorothy Gundy.
Michael Morris is a curator with New York's Museum of Jewish Heritage. He was trying to fulfill a common request when he uncovered a number of artworks. They were images of the Holocaust by people who were there. Using those works, Morris put together a show of art. Many are by some of the 6 million Jews killed by the Nazis in the 1930s and 40s. The show is against and educates about the dangers of anti-Semitism, racism, bigotry of any kind, said Morris. He added, "We see hundreds of thousands of people in concentration camps. These are actual people who had multifaceted lives." Among them was 12-year-old Helga Vysova. She brought art supplies with her when she was sent to Terezin concentration camp north of Prague in October 1944. Before she was forced to go to Auschwitz, another prisoner gave the drawings to her uncle. He hid them behind a wall. Auschwitz was the infamous Nazi concentration camp in southern Poland. Her 1943 work in colored pencil on paper is called Transport Leaving Terezin. It shows guards with guns watching a group of prisoners carrying their few belongings. Vysova is now in her 90s and living in Prague. But many of the artists never made it out of the deadly camps. Peter Lovenstein of Czechoslovakia was sent in 1941 to Terezin. He gave 70 drawings to his mother before he was forced to go in 1944 to Auschwitz. His mother and sister would soon be sent to Auschwitz as well. Before they left, they gave the art to a family friend. His sister was the only family member who survived the camp. She recovered the works after the war, including 8 men in coats with stars. It is a 1944 ink-on-paper picture of Jews forced to wear a Star of David on their clothing for identification. There is also a powerful watercolor by Marvin Hollier, a member of the 104th Infantry Division of the U.S. Army. His division liberated or freed Nordhausen concentration camp in Germany in 1945. After seeing the few surviving prisoners covering thousands of bodies, he rushed to paint civilians covering corpses. The show opens as anti-Semitic hate crimes increase across the United States. Many have happened in New York City, home to the largest Jewish community outside of Israel. Anti-Jewish hate crimes in New York in 2019 were at a 28-year high, said Professor Brian Levin. He is director of the Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University in San Bernardino. In the most recent attack, a man with a machete wounded 5 people. They were gathered last month for a Hanukkah celebration at the home of a rabbi just outside the city. A few weeks earlier, a shooting at a Jewish market in nearby Jersey City, New Jersey, killed 2 men. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Many Asian countries are making final preparations for Lunar New Year celebrations. In China, the Lunar New Year holiday will begin this Friday, January 24th. Under the country's traditional zodiac system, the next 12 months will be known as the Year of the Rat. Food is an important part of the yearly celebration, and pork, the meat from pigs, is central to many Lunar New Year meals. But this year could be different in China because of African swine fever virus, also known as African swine flu. The disease, which affects farm animals, has led to the loss of huge numbers of pigs on Chinese farms. Swine flu has affected the country's meat industry in a big way. Official records released last week showed that pork production fell by 21% over the past year. In addition, the Agriculture Ministry reported that the number of pigs kept at Chinese farms had fallen by 40% by October. As a result, pork prices all over the country have increased by about 200% because of a shortage. The high price of pork has added to inflation, which has now reached an 8-year high. A Reuters news agency reporter spoke to Xu, a woman from central China. Her family lost their herd of pigs to swine flu. Now she is sharply cutting back on her use of pork for the holiday. Pork just costs too much. People can't bear the price. China's government has provided more than 200,000 tons of frozen pork since December to increase supplies for the Lunar New Year holiday. The country also imported 375,000 tons in December, a record amount. During the winter months, traditional cured pork products, such as la ro, are very popular. But this season, la ro sellers are reporting slow sales and fewer people looking to buy. Zhang Sheng has sold cured pork in a market in the city of Guiyang for the past 5 years. This year, pork is very expensive, so individual customers are buying less la ro, Zhang said. In Shanghai, 4 cured pork makers told Reuters that their businesses are suffering because of price increases between 20 and 30%. I imagine many people will be having more chicken and duck this new year, one seller said. I'm Mario Ritter Jr.
Imagine that you work in a university admissions office. You see the applications of two students who have the same test scores. One would be the first in her family to attend college. The other is the child of a graduate of the same university. If you follow your school's traditional policy, you must admit the child of the previous graduate. Until recently, many of the top private U.S. universities were more likely to admit the child of a graduate of that university than a student with a similar educational record. These legacy admissions have been questioned by educators, and most admissions officers say they are not fair. Johns Hopkins University is considered one of the top universities in the United States. In a speech early this month, President Ronald J. Daniels said the children of Hopkins graduates already have many social and educational advantages. He added that it is hard to understand why legacy admissions still exist in a country that values merit and equal opportunity. For that reason, Hopkins has ended the practice in recent years. Among the world's top universities, five say they will not consider the family's history with the school in admission. The schools include MIT, Caltech, Oxford, Cambridge, and the University of California, Berkeley. In the 2018 survey of American college admissions officers, Inside Higher Ed says 42% of admissions officers at private schools said that legacy is still a factor in admissions decisions. The numbers are much lower, at 6% for public colleges. Colleges that allow legacy admissions say that they are able to raise more money if they favor children of alumni. The money, in turn, helps other students with financial needs. They also note that students of college-educated parents are more likely to try for and complete an undergraduate degree than students whose parents did not attend college. Deborah Koh and James Davidson of Purdue University studied the origins of legacy admission. They say it began in the 1920s as a way to keep Jewish, non-white, and immigrant students from attending the university. The result was a mostly white, Christian student body. In modern times, affirmative action by American universities is part of an effort to create a more diverse community on campus. Affirmative action considers the race of an applicant along with other qualities like economic status. In 2014, a special interest group, Students for Fair Admissions, or SFFA, brought legal action against Harvard University. The group argued that Harvard held Asian Americans to a higher standard in admissions. The group said the Ivy League school gave preference to Black and Hispanic students with lower grades. During a court hearing, a Harvard University dean said it was important for Harvard to favor the children of alumni in order to bring students who have more experience with Harvard together with others who are less familiar with Harvard. Putting these different groups of students together, he added, would make them more effective students and citizen leaders for society. A federal judge ruled in 2019 that the school's admission policy does not discriminate against Asian American students, and the SFFA is appealing the decision. At Johns Hopkins University, officials reported that removing their legacy admissions has resulted in a diverse student body with high academic abilities. In the past, there were more students with family ties to the university than those who needed federal financial aid. Now, there are more students who need financial aid than those with family connections. A recent gift to Johns Hopkins allows the school to admit students no matter how much money they can pay. Former New York City Mayor Michael R. Bloomberg announced in November that he is giving a record $1.8 billion to the university. It is thought to be the largest private donation ever given a university. Bloomberg graduated from Hopkins in 1964. He said his gift was meant to support student financial aid at the school and make its admissions process forever need blind. I'm Jill Robbins.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The war between the United States and Spain in 1898 was one of the shortest in American history. The fighting lasted about 3 months. Yet that short war led to long-term changes for America. Victory made the United States an increasingly important world power. Larry West and Shep O'Neill tell about those developments.
The United States received several of Spain's island colonies as part of the peace agreement. The most important was the Philippines. Many Americans thought the United States should not have overseas territories. But President William McKinley thought the Philippines were unprepared for independence. He decided to keep the islands and prepare the people for self-government in the future. A Filipino nationalist group, led by Emilio Aguinaldo, rejected American control. Aguinaldo declared the formation of a Philippine Republic, and he started a guerrilla war against the occupying forces.
The rebellion in the Philippines became a major issue in America's presidential election of 1900. The Republican Party renominated William McKinley as president. And it nominated a hero of the Spanish-American War, New York Governor Theodore Roosevelt, as vice president. The Democratic Party, for the second time, nominated Congressman William Jennings Bryan as president. It nominated a former vice president, Adlai Stevenson, as vice president again.
William Jennings Bryan campaigned against the American takeover of the Philippines. He received support from a new group, the Anti-Imperialist League. Members included leading American politicians, businessmen, and writers. President McKinley did not campaign much. He let vice presidential candidate Theodore Roosevelt do it. Roosevelt spoke of America's success as a new economic and political power in the world. He said the Republican Party was responsible. The majority of voters liked what Roosevelt said. They elected the Republican candidates.
The Republican victory destroyed the hopes of many nationalists in the Philippines. With William McKinley in the White House again, they saw little chance of gaining independence. Nationalist leader Emilio Aguinaldo, however, refused to surrender. As long as he remained free, the guerrilla war would continue. For months, American forces tried, without success, to find him. Finally, with the help of a tribe of Filipino mercenary soldiers called the Macabebe Scouts, they captured him. Aguinaldo signed an agreement to support the United States. With this agreement, the rebellion ended on the island of Luzon, but it continued for more than a year in the southern Philippines. Hostilities ended officially on July 4, 1902.
American occupation of the Philippines made the United States a major power in the Far East. As such, it began to develop new policies toward Asia, especially a new policy toward China. Americans had been trading with China for years, but not heavily. As the American economy grew, however, businessmen saw China, with a population of 400 million people, as a great market for American products. Other countries were interested in this market, too. Britain, France, Germany, Japan, and Russia all claimed special rights in parts of China. They began to divide the country into areas called spheres of influence. It seemed these areas could become foreign colonies. Then the United States would be cut off from trading directly with China. To prevent that from happening, American Secretary of State John Hay proposed what became known as the Open Door Policy.
Secretary Hay asked the nations involved to agree to equal trading rights for all countries in all parts of China. No nation, he said, should interfere with the rights or powers of any other nation in China. No one welcomed the proposal, but no one rejected it either. Most of the nations involved said they agreed with the idea, but they said they could not approve it unless everyone else did. Secretary Hay refused to wait for them to act. So in May 1900, he announced that all the nations involved had given their approval to the Open Door Policy. The new policy was tested very soon. Within a month of Hay's announcement, violence broke out against foreigners in China.
The attacks were led by a secret group called Righteous Harmonious Fists. Foreigners called its members Boxers. Boxers hated all foreign influence in China. They organized in areas where foreign influence was strongest. They killed Christian missionaries and Chinese who had accepted the Christian religion. They also destroyed foreign industries, especially railroads. The Chinese government in Beijing supported the Boxer Rebellion. It permitted the Boxers to occupy the capital. The rebellion lasted about 2 months. It ended when an allied force of American, British, French, German, and Japanese soldiers reached Beijing and ended the Boxer occupation.
The foreign powers began to negotiate with China on paying for damages. The United States was worried about the results. It believed some of the nations involved would use the Boxer Rebellion as a way to gain more control over Chinese territory. Secretary of State Hay quickly announced America's policy on the issue. The United States, he said, wanted a settlement which would bring peace
and safety to China. The settlement must protect China's territorial rights so it would not be divided into foreign colonies. Britain and Germany agreed. With their help, Secretary Hay got the others to accept money, not territory, as payment for damages. The final settlement forced China to pay $333 million. The United States used some of its share to pay for the education of Chinese students in America.
The results of the Boxer Rebellion and the Spanish-American War made clear that the new century would have a new world power, the United States. And this new power had a president with the political skills to do the job, William McKinley. In September 1901, President McKinley made a major foreign policy speech at the Pan American Fair in Buffalo, New York. He spoke about the importance and the promise of America's new position in the world. The next day, President McKinley went to the fair's Temple of Music. He planned to spend several hours meeting the public and shaking hands.
A young man waited in line to see him. When the young man stepped in front of McKinley, McKinley reached out to shake his hand. Two shots rang out from a gun the man had hidden under a cloth. One of the bullets struck McKinley in the stomach. The president was taken to an emergency hospital on the fairgrounds. He was not conscious. The bullet had damaged his stomach, pancreas, and one kidney. But doctors did not believe he was in danger of dying.
The man who shot McKinley was Leon Czolgosz. Czolgosz was an anarchist. He believed all rulers were enemies of the people. He believed the people had the right to kill them. Czolgosz also was mentally ill. He had tried to join several anarchist groups. They refused to accept him, however, because of his mental condition. After shooting President McKinley, Czolgosz explained why he had done it. He said it was not right for one man to receive so much public honor, while he received none.
For 2 days, the president remained in a coma. Then his condition changed. He regained consciousness and was able to talk. He rested and became stronger. Then the president's condition changed again. An infection developed in his wound. It spread throughout his body. In another few days, he was dead.
Vice President Roosevelt hurried to Buffalo. He went to the house where the president's body lay. Then he went to another house to be sworn in as president. He was 42 years old, the youngest man ever to hold the office. Roosevelt declared that the administration would go on as before. "It is my aim," he said, "to continue unbroken the policy of President McKinley for the peace, the prosperity, and the honor of our beloved country."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.